Renowned author Anne Lamott, whose latest work of nonfiction is Help, Thanks, Wow, The Three Essential Prayers, is in town this morning to speak at Hudson Valley Community College in Troy at 11 a.m., and we're thrilled that she stopped by here first. Anne Lamott uses humor to get her messages across about motherhood, loss, spirituality, alcoholism in her novels and her nonfiction. Among her works are Operating Instructions, Hard Laughter, Rosie, and Some Assembly Required, a journey of my son's first son, which is just out in paperback. She is one of my favorite guests, and it's an absolute delight to have her here in the studio. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I feel as though a prayer has been answered by having you here. You know, I've read every word you've ever written, and I just find you to be such a presence on the page. I love your spirit and vibe, and I feel better after you've been on the show many times. So after I talk to you, after I read you, I just feel better, and I think that a lot of people agree with me on that, which is obviously why, you know, you're always on the bestseller list, because people want to feel a little bit better about themselves.
Yeah, why not? I mean, it's so hard here on Earth. It's never been a good match for me, and it's exhausting, and it's stressful, and it's very strange, and why not just remember too that you're just great. You're just where you're supposed to be. Just breathe and maybe have a nice glass of water. That's my message.
have you accepted that role that people follow you in a sense because they look to you to see your thoughts on things? That role?
I don't really see it as a role. I'm kind of amazed by the whole circumstance of my career. And I really just try to, I used to tell my writing students, write what you'd love to come upon. And so I write for Facebook or Salon or in my books what I'd love to come upon, you know, reminders that most of the stuff we obsess or think about is total meaningless, you know, just habit, and that most things kind of sort themselves out, and that we're loved and we're safe, and there are a few people who will never let us go through this life in this veil of tears alone, and that we're okay and we can relax a little bit more. So I keep writing that because then I remember and I go, oh, right. Also that we're in charge and control of so little. And whenever somebody reminds me that, I feel resentful and bitter because I think I'm in charge of so much and that my ideas are such good ideas and that my help is so helpful. But if I'm reminded that none of those things are true, I get my sense of humor back. And so I get my buoyancy. And I said in Plan B that laughter is carbonated holiness. And when I get my sense of humor back about myself, usually, I feel like grace has arrived. And I just feel so generous all of a sudden and playful.
The words that you bring such meaning to, like grace and faith, are maybe not our typical definitions. We see that in the new book of Help, Thanks, Wow, The Three Essential Prayers, of words that have a lot of different meanings to a lot of different people, and unfortunately, maybe to the point are overused so that they lose their true meaning and purpose.
Well, I think maybe they've lost their true meaning and purpose by being used as weapons and punishment and shaming tools by the Christian right. So that I think a lot of the people who come to hear me or who read my books have been already driven out of their homes by having been raised on a diet of imperfection, of being told they're so imperfect and really repulsive. And they don't want that. That's not what they imagine. God, as we might understand God, I sort of imagine God as Isaac Stern, a cross between Isaac Stern and Bette Midler. I mean, very Jewish. And so, like, grace is lovely. Grace is a little bit of buoyancy.
Yeah.
It's maybe a little bit of fresh air when you're in the worst sort of claustrophobia. It's maybe somehow against all odds being able to unclench, you know, let go. And I've always said everything I let go of has claw marks on it. So it's not like it comes easily to me. But you let go and you relax a little bit and you go, you sigh and you say, okay, fine, whatever. And that to me is what grace is. Grace to me is largely associated with getting my sense of gentleness and sense of humor back.
You mentioned the Christian rite, and I find it fascinating, and it's one of those things that I guess I will never quite understand, where you can preach from the Word of God, and use it as a weapon, as you said, against a person's lifestyle, against what they do, what they don't do, and I don't think. You know, it seems like the obvious message of most, whatever your religious affiliation or not non-religious affiliation, is a sense of peace and a sense of calm and a sense of fairness, and I don't know, trying to figure that out in my mind, I have a lot of difficulty. I don't quite get it.
I know. Well, the thing is that the Christian rite and their demonstrations are so much more interesting than moderates and the left and progressives that are also believers, because soup is not that interesting. Like to watch people gather up shoes and discarded eyeglasses to take to the most vulnerable and poor is not great footage. But somebody burning a Quran or just going on a complete bizarre tear, like just, I mean this observationally, let's say, not with judgment, but just to watch Michelle Bachmann in action. That's who people think of as Christians in this world. So, but, you know, I've been in New England for a long time, and I've been to some of the great, like Arlington Street Church, some of the great sanctuary churches from civil rights and from Vietnam days, and the anti-racist churches, the churches whose intention is to be anti-racist and all-inclusive, and to say, you are welcome here, you are loved and chosen, we want you. And that's what I think of as the religious people who are sort of my people, that I can't quite explain this Jesus-y thing. It was sort of an accident. But I have a lot in common with probably half the believers in this country, which is that I think that you're here to get thirsty people glasses of water and to sit down when people seem very, very lonely, and to maybe sacrifice half of your to-do list to sit with a lonely person and to say, you know, I got a few minutes. What's going on? Or are you thirsty? Can I get you a glass of water? So, you know, I take what I like and leave the rest. The Christian bookstores don't carry my books for the most part because I'm pro-choice and I'm so pro women's rights, and I'm such an old aging hippie pacifist and environmentalist. But mostly it's a pro-choice thing. So, you know, who cares?
What I find interesting is the audiences, and having heard you speak, where people will get up and talk to you and who are non-believers, mm-hmm. but they attach themselves to you because your writing resonates with them. They will often say, because there is that, okay, while they don't have that belief in God that you have, what they do have is a belief that we should be good to one another, a belief that we can get along with each other. And as you just indicated, if someone is thirsty, you offer them the glass of water.
Well, and maybe also without feeling any kind of connection to the word God or to the idea of a divine intelligence, maybe they have been deeply influenced by Walt Whitman and Emerson, and they feel that sort of transcendental, that there is a reality deeper than the one we can measure. Like, wow, the third prayer from the latest book is about that sense of having your mouth drop open, you know, with wonder and with being touched and moved, like in the Hudson Valley, say, very easy and obvious. At nighttime, people don't walk out under a starry sky if they remember to look up from their cell phones. If they look up, they don't go, well, it's a medium starry night. You look up at the stars and you say, wow. You look out at a beautiful spring day after cold and rain, and you say, wow, you might even say thank you without believing that you're addressing anything or anyone in particular. You're expressing gratitude, which is about as spiritual as our walk is on this earth after getting thirsty people water. You walk into a church, a sanctuary, church in Mexico City and you say, wow, not because you're into the Jesus or the Mary or the whatever, but because you're blown away, because there's something going on, some kind of energetic field around you that makes you feel like you're hooked into something bigger than you for a few minutes here and there. So, you know, whether you use the word God or higher power or nothing, just it, the holy enchilada, the not me. Not me is a great name for God, as is Phil. It doesn't matter. We're all experiencing that, those moments where the thin place, where you sort of feel like you're here with your regular old life, and you're also experiencing some sort of vibrational shift where you're almost laughing because it's so beautiful.
Anne Lamott is our guest on the roundtable this morning. Her new book is Help, Thanks, Wow, The Three Essential Prayers. The new book just out in paperback, is called Some Assembly Required, a journal of my son's first son. And she is speaking at Hudson Valley Community College in Troy at 11 a.m. So you still have time to head over there and have a wonderful time at HVCC. You know, you talk about Michelle Bachmann and many people seeing her as a face of what people think of as Christian.
Right.
What do you make of the politicalization of religion and how we can divorce ourselves from that while still being, as you very much are, a political being?
I think the appropriate response to the current political situation and reality, and all of it, and you know, the politicizing Christianity, which isn't my huge thing. It's the attack and the assault on women and women's rights, but it just fills you with grief and rage. But I happen to believe, as you know from reading myself, that grief and rage are the way home. And having been raised a woman in the 50s, a girl, I was taught to believe that an angry woman will be banished or labeled a witch. And I was taught that you really must not grieve for an unseemly amount of time, i.e. weeks. And there's sort of a grid, a grief grid that you're handed at a pretty early age, that if you were to lose a husband or wife, 18 months, if you were to lose a brother or a sister, probably 6 months to a year, best friend, 3 to 6 months. It's just like obvious that you should be doing better than you are. But I don't think we ever finish grieving certain losses. I don't think we're supposed to. I think it keeps our hearts open. I think it's like meat tenderizer. It keeps us softer. I think tears are one of the most profound things that we finally allow ourselves to do, because they wash us, they heal us, they baptize us, they moisten the ground at our feet. I was just at Arlington Church, the great anti-war and anti-racist, pro-rights church in Boston, for my dad's birthday on Monday. Mm. And he would have been 90, and he died in 1979, wow, 3 years younger than I am now. And the old man, the old minister there, George, took us up to the tallest peak of the church, looking out the whole world in the commons. And he played on the ancient New England bells, Happy Birthday to my dad. And I cried because I really miss my dad. I just loved him. It was great to have a dad in the world.
Right.
But you're told, oh, for God's sake, it's coming up on 35 years or something. And I know people who have lost a brother. I know people, I lost a best friend. I don't agree to stop feeling very sad that that person is not reachable. Now, I may have experiences with them in a different way, in a heart way, in the heart cave, or in the hearing of certain pieces of music, but I don't agree not to feel bad because somebody else thinks I should. I agree to nothing that the House GOP thinks. I agree to nothing, not one thing, that Rand Paul thinks. So I may be a person who's kind of a mess, still sad, laughing and way too much, practicing radical silliness at the age of 59, and fighting for truth and women's rights and anti-war and all of it. And it's fine. Everybody gets to think what they think.
When you, by the way, a belated happy birthday.
Thank you.
You celebrated your birthday on Wednesday.
Yes, I
and,
did.
And anyone who listens to Writer's Almanac, Garrison Keillor, who did a nice shout out to you on your birthday. I think that when you certainly had a conversion in your life, but you talked about anger. Did you ever identify yourself as an angry person?
Well, it's funny. In Operating Instructions, which is the precursor to Some Assembly Required, I was 35 years old when I had a child, and until that time, I had never raised my voice. I was raised to be a perfect girl. I was a perfect girl. I was like flight attendant to the world. My job was to help men not feel so much shame about the catastrophe they had wrought on women and children. So I put their boulders and their little rocks in my backpack, and I suppressed it all. I, as God is my witness, I did not shout. My parents had a horrible marriage. They did not raise their voice in 27 years. But when I had Sam, I had so few mental defenses, because you're so wasted. You're so beyond wasted as a parent, that I started to realize I'm really mad. I mean, the women's movement, which is where I found salvation when I was 16, where my life began, where the eyes of my eyes were opened, I understood that if, like my friend Pat said, if you were over the age of 12 and were an American girl and you weren't angry, you'd completely miss the boat.
Right.
And so I understood that that was true, but I was too shy and too much of a people pleaser to be angry. And ever since then, I've been getting the help to be an appropriately angry person. And so
appropriately
angry person. You know, a lot of people that are angry, it's so suppressed because they like to think of themselves is so holy or so evolved or so progressive or whatever, that they need to dominate. They need to collect women. They need to collect people to feel powerful over. But it's really just their rage, and the rage is probably just their grief.
Does that appropriate anger, does it arise within you surprisingly? In a surprising fashion sometimes. I ask because I was really moved a week or so ago when we were listening to the testimony that was going on in the Supreme Court regarding gay marriage. And I just there was that moment of a flash of anger that came through me and said, why are we in court over this? Why are we arguing this case? What is there about this that is, when all that is going on in the world? And I sort of startled myself because of the flash of anger. But so does, two-part question. One, do you find that where it comes out surprisingly? And then the follow-up to it is then how do you quell it and use it to some good?
Well, it can always be used for good, and it will always be a blessing if you have somebody to help you with it. You know, you need kind of a birth coach, because it's so terrifying in our families to not get angry, to not express anger, or even sadness was life or death. It was just a way we learned to survive, was really not to have a lot of feelings that made other people uncomfortable, and to have as few needs as possible. And so to become a fully integrated grown-up and to become a person of life and being awake here and being conscious, striving for consciousness here, means you're going to have to deal with the whole shebang, the whole garden, even the blackberry brambles and the rotted wood pile. And you don't need to do, one does not need to do it alone. I'm someone who's needed a lot of help. I have three or four friends who I think of as my pit crew, who are the reason my faith is so huge, is because the quality and the outrageous wonderfulness of my few best friends, to whom I tell anything. I have learned to do my anger. I have learned. But, you know, the thing is that the anger comes up at it for me, and maybe for you also. It's kind of cerebral. You think, why on earth are we even having this discussion?
Yeah.
It's 2013. But you think it. And you might have a little bit of a blush or flush of, God almighty. And then, but that isn't, that's not body. That's not body and heart, which is where I think it needs to come out, whether it's about pounding the pillow or beating the bed with a tennis racket or getting in the car and shouting and screaming. But I have needed a birth coach, and it has all the ugly stuff been transformed into blessing. It has convinced me to stop hitting the snooze button so often and to wake up to understand that life here is very short and beyond precious, and everything I need is within me, and I get to ask for help, which was another thing in my family we didn't do. I was the help. I was the flight attendant. I have an older brother, a younger brother, unhappy parents, and I had a little clipboard, I think, by about four, and I was the priest and the therapist. I was the wife to my father and the mother to my mother. And I had to say at some point, probably around 40, no mas.
Yeah. Anne Lamott has been our guest on the roundtable this morning. Her new book out in hardcover is called Help, Thanks, Wow, The Three Essential Prayers. There is a brand new paperback out as well of her last book, which is entitled Some Assembly Required, A Journal of My Son's First Son, published by Riverhead. Anne Lamott will be at Hudson Valley Community College in Troy at 11 a.m. this morning, speaking the end of a long book tour. And I am just delighted that you could spend time with us this morning. Just having you in here, it just means an awful lot to me. And I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.